Public Enemy. This is a hot dog.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, that is, and this is my show every Saturday from 3 to 5 o'clock Texas time on the Republic Broadcasting Network. And this is the Weekend Interview Show for January the 8th, 2005. Hope everybody had a great Christmas and New Year's, both of which fell on Saturday this time. So I haven't done a show for about 3 weeks, so here I am again. I hope everybody enjoyed the reruns. And I have a great guest this hour. The second hour, it'll just be you and me. But first hour here, we have Thomas L. Knapp. And I really like this guy because, you know, he's a thinker and a writer, but he's also a rubber meets the road guy, too. He's the publisher of the website Rational Review, which also does the Rational Review News Digest, which I subscribe to. And he has his own blog, Napster.blogspot. He is also has been a Libertarian House candidate. He was the media coordinator for the Michael Badnar campaign for president, and now is part of something called the Boston Tea Party, which you can look up at bostontea.us. Welcome to the show, Thomas L. Knapp.
Hi, how you doing, Scott?
I'm doing great. It's great to have you on again.
Great to be on again.
So tell me, what is the Boston Tea Party?
Oh, boy. The Boston Tea Party is not a political party. Sort of like new is not Unix. It's an effort to get together pledges for a presidential candidate who supports the Bill of Rights in 2008.
And that's expected to be a Republican or a Democrat?
Right. There's no partisan attachments there. The way we're doing things is basically people join the Boston Tea Party via a web form. And all they do is they give us their contact information and how much money they would be willing to donate to a presidential candidate who supports the Bill of Rights. Over the next 4 years, we will come up with a process for choosing such a candidate who might be the Republican, Democratic, or Libertarian nominee, or the Green nominee, or an independent. Once we've chosen that candidate, then we'll give the candidate the contact information for the people who have said, hey, I want to give that kind of candidate money.
Great. So this is to be pressure from below for the Bill of Rights, which is, I suppose, supposed to be the law of the land, right?
Right. An incentive program, I guess, is what you would call it. The goal, and we're nowhere near it, we've only raised pledges of a few thousand dollars so far, is to have pledges of $10 million from voters who want to see that kind of candidate. $10 million certainly isn't enough to make a winning presidential campaign, but it's not chump change either.
Well, and if the Republican and the Democrat, as expected, in 2008, have no attachment to the Bill of Rights whatsoever, then that would be an incredible windfall to a Libertarian or a Green candidate, right?
Oh, right. If it's a third-party candidate who's not Ross Perot or somebody, that kind of money represents, you know, twice as much or more as any of those third parties have ever been able to spend on a presidential campaign before.
So, what exactly was the impetus to creating this thing? Is this show maybe a lack of confidence in the Libertarian Party as the usual vehicle for this kind of activism?
No, I don't think so. I was a member of the Libertarian Party for 8 years. I still support libertarians, and I am a small L libertarian. I'm just not a member of the party anymore. Really, a lot of it came out of discussions I've seen over the years as to what it would take to do an effective libertarian political campaign. One of the numbers that was thrown around was $10 million. If you look at...
Hold tight, Tom. We're going to go to a break here, and we'll be right back. We'll be right back. everybody. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. Our guest this hour is Thomas L. Knapp. You can look up what he writes and produces and publishes at rationalreview.com, Napster.blogspot, and that's KNAPPSTER.blogspot, striketheroot.com, he also writes for them, and BostonTea.us, and that's what we're talking about, is the Boston Tea Party. Now, I'm sorry when I interrupted you a good 20 seconds before the commercial there, Tom. You were saying that you had been talking with some people, and you had figured out that if a Libertarian candidate had about $10 million, that that would really be what it would take to really have a successful campaign.
Well, no, I won't say that. I don't believe in silver bullets. I don't think that the Libertarian Party or Libertarian candidates who may not be LP candidates are going to find some magical silver bullet that will just make them successful. But $10 million is a number I've heard thrown around as sort of a bare minimum to really be competitive. And if you look at past third-party campaigns, Pat Buchanan had about $12.5 million in federal money in 2000, but I think that's anomalous in that there were questions about how it was spent. Ross Perot was a billionaire who was able to fund his own campaign to the tune of tens of millions. And he did fairly well. He did 20% in 1992 and nearly 10% in 1996. Libertarian candidates or third-party candidates in general, Michael Bednarik, the LP's candidate this last cycle, raised and spent about $1 million. The Green candidate, David Cobb, raised and spent about $100,000. That's not enough to gain the name recognition or the public impact on consciousness to accomplish anything. You're the only votes they're able to get are their base, because nobody else hears about them. Nobody else really is reachable until you start getting into the $10 million bracket in terms of money.
Well, what are you going to demand, assuming you can raise that kind of scratch for the next time around? What are you going to demand of the candidate in order to get that $10 million?
Well, we have not arranged, we haven't come up with the process yet, and I'm working with several other Bill of Rights-minded people on the process. We're probably not going to demand anything. What we're going to do is we're going to basically set up a checklist of positions that agree with the Bill of Rights. And we're going to look at the candidates and say, how well do their positions match this, and are they emphasizing those positions? So, a candidate would basically start with a supposition of 100%, but if they favored laws that abridge the freedom of speech or religion or the press, you take points off. Same thing if they, don't support gun rights. And then we look and, try to find the candidate who's closest to 100% in terms of the Bill of Rights.
Who else is involved with you in this project?
There are several Austin-area libertarians that I've been talking with. We're going to announce a steering committee soon and hopefully put together a larger online event for next year where anybody who wants to can participate. I'm not from Austin, but I've worked Texans. Texans are great people. I've talked with Alan Weiss of Austin about this. I've talked with Catherine Graham of San Antonio. Initially, he agreed to. We haven't talked lately, but I suspect our honorary chair will be L. Neil Smith of Fort Collins, Colorado. Great science fiction author and hardcore libertarian who developed a concept called Bill of Rights Enforcement.
And what's that about, the Bill of Rights Enforcement?
Essentially, it's the notion that what we need are politicians who will obey the Bill of Rights and who will enforce the law against those politicians who infringe it. The United States Code, Title 18, Sections 241 and 242, make it a felony to conspire to violate people's rights. So, when we have politicians who can get together and conspire to take away people's guns or to put them in jail because of what they say or to prevent people from observing a religion that requires they use certain chemical substances in their sacraments, they are breaking the law. The Bill of Rights is the law.
Well, do you guys distinguish between which politicians the Bill of Rights binds? Because, of course, originally the Bill of Rights was strictly a list of restrictions against federal power, and now, more often than not, it is seen as a grant of power to the national government to be enforced on the states.
There's a lot of small internal issues there that you have to resolve. Now, the Boston Tea Party, BostonTea.us, is concentrating on the federal level. We're looking at a presidential candidate to support.
Right.
Where, you know, hopefully we will eventually have state-level affiliate organizations that advocate preserving those same rights at the state and local level. Also, some of the Bill of Rights is not as uniform as one might think in that respect. It says certain things. The First Amendment says that Congress can't abridge the freedom of speech. The Second Amendment says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It does not say by who. It does not limit just the federal government. It has
point.
A period after that.
Very good point there.
It's a right that textually in the Constitution is reserved to the people and not subject to the whim of the states.
Well, and you know, Tom, while we're at it, we might as well discuss the fact that the Bill of Rights really has been kind of turned inside out from its original purpose, where it was explicitly a list of restrictions against the national government. In fact, it's pretty hard to find, I guess nowadays with Google it shouldn't be too hard, the preamble to the Bill of Rights, which is hardly ever included in any published version of the Constitution that I've ever seen, says that these are declaratory and restrictive clauses placed there to ensure greater confidence in the new government to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers. And this is, I guess, the same point is reaffirmed in the Ninth Amendment, which says that, hey, just because there's a list of rights here doesn't mean this is the list of rights. It just means this is a specific list of things that you cannot violate, but rights are still retained by us.
That's correct. As a matter of fact, Hamilton argued against the Bill of Rights on the basis that if the Constitution did not specifically say the federal government could do something, it had no power to do it.
Right, a Bill of Rights was something originally granted by a king to his subjects.
Exactly, yeah. Under Magna Carta and as the English Constitution developed in common law and now the English did things in sort of an evolutionary way, whereas the United States did it in a revolutionary way and then codified in the Constitution. The Bill of Rights is a restriction on what the government can do. That's what it is. There's nothing you will find in the Bill of Rights that provides the government with any powers whatsoever. It tells them what they can't do.
Well, do you have anything else to say on this topic except to go ahead and give out your website and encourage people to go look at it?
Not especially. I mean, we're just getting started. The next presidential election's 4 years away, and I confess that I've become somewhat distracted from promoting it as I should have at the outset, but we will be getting going on that soon. It's bostontea.us is the website, and feel free to drop by.
And by the way, I should say, if you do go to bostontea.us, be sure to click on the article by O'Neill Smith about the Bill of Rights enforcement. It's actually very interesting. And it's funny because I think the first time I ever heard O'Neill Smith's name, it was because he co-wrote a book with Aaron Zellman from the Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. And so he's a good, I know for a fact, he's one of those Second Amendment first kind of libertarians. I appreciate
yes,
that.
He's co-written two books with Zellman. One is called The Mitzvah, and the second one is sort of a sequel to The Mitzvah. It's called Hope. They're both great little novels that tend to concentrate on the Second Amendment, but not entirely.
Cool. Well, hey, man, you're for talking about all sorts of interesting things with, so make sure toward the end of the interview to remind everybody about bostontea.us. But I got plenty of other things here to discuss with you, Tom, particularly something on your blog about American tactics in Iraq that you wrote. It's very interesting. So I should ask you, what's the problem with American tactics in Iraq?
Well, let me make it up. The problem with American tactics in Iraq is that we have American soldiers in Iraq to start with. That's
big tactical flaw number one. Huh?
Strategic flaw, actually.
Yeah.
I oppose that. But I get hate mail. Some of it's not even actually hate mail. Some of it's genuinely concerned email. In doing Rational Review News Digest, the first item of news every day is how many Americans have been killed in Iraq that in the previous 24 hours, and also how many Iraqis have been killed. What's going on in Iraq? And I get emails from people, we know you're against the war, but why don't you, make constructive suggestions on how we can win it and get out of there? And I don't think the war is winnable. But to the extent that it is, I've noticed... And I'm an old Marine, 10 years in the Marine Corps. I fought in the 1991 Gulf War. And I'm a tactical guy. I wasn't a general. I was a sergeant. I've noticed that a lot of the American casualties seem to have to do with patrolling in vehicles which is a very strange concept to me. Vehicles aren't intended for patrolling. You use your feet for patrolling so that you can disperse your unit. An improvised explosive device won't kill 13 people. It will kill one. So I wrote this little article on patrolling tactics. I've patrolled. I've led patrols. I've trained, taught people in patrolling, and I decided to write a little essay on what the problems seem to be there.
Well, Tom, does it matter if they're in an aluminum Humvee or in a Bradley armored vehicle?
Well, that depends on who's shooting at them and what they're being shot at with. But the bottom line is that any number of soldiers in a tin can with wheels on it are one target. And when that target is struck, if it's struck hard enough, the people inside it are going to be injured or killed. Being inside a vehicle also limits your visibility. It makes it harder to hear what's going on around you. It lets people know that you're coming. I hear bumper music.
Yeah, you do. That's the Cantina song. I love this song. It's great. All right, I'll go ahead and shut you up now. We can listen to the rest of the song and then a bunch of commercials. And we'll be right back with Thomas L. Knapp from Rational Review. It's the Weekend Interview Show. We're back on the Weekend Interview Show with Thomas L. Knapp from RationalReview.com, and we're talking about tactics in patrolling Iraq, how our soldiers shouldn't be in Iraq anyway, but since they're there, Tom says they'd probably be a lot better walking around on foot doing their patrols rather than driving around in aluminum cans known as Humvees and getting blown to smithereens. Tom?
Oh, well, I mean, that's sort of the summary, and it sounds harsh. I don't want to come off like a know-it-all here. It's hard to tell what's going on in Iraq. The coverage out of Iraq is not that good. But when you see a news story that says seven soldiers were killed on Thursday when an improvised explosive device blew up their Bradley fighting vehicle while they were on patrol, and you see a series of stories like that, you have to ask, okay, well, what were they doing on patrol in a Bradley fighting vehicle? If you look back at the experience in Vietnam, which is another war that I think was a bad idea, one of the reasons that the North and the Viet Cong and the Communists were able to triumph in places there was this tendency to button up behind barbed wire, to convoy from place to place if you had to go. They used this more or less random artillery fire. It was called harassment interdiction fire, and that left the enemy effectively able to move wherever he felt like, whenever he felt like, and do what he wanted. In the places where the U.S. did well in Vietnam, it was under the tutelage of a man named John Paul Vann, who said, no, that's not what we do. We have bases, but we don't stay holed up in them, and we don't, you know, just run truck convoys to get from place to place. We vigorously patrol the area. We get to know the people. We know what's going on, and we set the agenda. Right now in Iraq, if the coverage that you see coming out of it is correct, basically, the U.S. is sitting there going out every once in a while and trying to kill what they euphemistically call insurgents, which I call the resistance. And other than that, staying behind their barbed wire and hoping not too many of them get killed. And when they do what they call patrolling, it seems to be in Humvees and Bradley fighting vehicles instead of, you know, in squad formations walking so that they are dispersed, so that if there's a bomb or a mine, one person gets killed instead of 10. And so that they can actually engage the enemy without the enemy knowing they're coming 10 minutes before because he hears the roar of diesel engines coming his way. I wrote a tactical article in response to requests that I, you know, come up with something constructive, and that tactics is my area. So,
well,
take it for what it's worth.
And that is constructive. I still feel sorry for the American soldiers over there. I know some people just like killing for a living, and so they go work for the government, but I think the vast majority of American soldiers are the victims of fraud. They were told that their job was to protect the United States, not to go around building empire. And I feel bad every time I hear about them getting killed. And, you know, frankly, that is constructive, assuming that any of them are paying any attention.
Well, I've actually already had a couple of emails from people who have relatives in Iraq who they forwarded my article to. My feeling is that it's not the privates and the sergeants and the lieutenants and the captains who are behind this idea of patrolling by vehicle. It's your higher-ranking officers who have been told, minimize casualties. They haven't spent a good deal of time in the field with boots on carrying a rifle. And so their first tendency is, well, how do I minimize casualties? I stick my troops inside things surrounding them and hopefully protecting them from fire. And that's intuitively how you prevent casualties, but it's counterintuitively it's not. The way you minimize casualties is an aggressive stance based on sound tactics.
It's funny, you know, I was reading the Financial Times this morning, and they quoted George Bush as saying that the Iraqi people have to be trained to defend themselves. And here I thought that was the problem, was that they were doing too good of a job.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're doing, you know, on the one hand, we have, you know, the casualties bother me. They bother me tremendously. More than 10,000 wounded, 6,000 wounded badly enough that they could not return to duty. More than 1,300 Americans killed in Iraq so far. It's ugly. It's a place we shouldn't be. Every death there is a needless death. But at the same time, there's a disconnect in reality there that the casualties aren't as bad as they could be. And we have leaders who seem extraordinarily worried about casualties, but not worried enough to get out.
Well, and there are people, and not just the politicians, but people on the pro-war right especially, are real quick to make comparisons and say, oh, well, you know, 58,000 guys died, of our guys died in Vietnam, or, you know, this many thousand died in World War II, and so that kind of makes this point moot, since we're only talking about 1,300 people.
I've actually made those comparisons myself, and I think that they favor Vietnam a bit. The fact is that medical science has advanced over the last 35 years, and people who would have died in Vietnam now live in Iraq, and they go on to the wounded total instead of the killed in action total. Also, if you look at the first couple of years of Vietnam, it wasn't until 1967, 1968 that things really got bad in Vietnam. The first 2 years in Vietnam, we lost 565 American troops. We've lost 1,318 months in Iraq.
Wow. All right, everybody, you heard it. It's Thomas L. Knapp. He runs RationalReview.com. It's a weekend interview show, and we'll be right back after more commercials. Everybody, it's the weekend interview show. I'm Scott Horton. Matt's in the booth running all the technicals, and the guest is Tom Knapp. The website, in case you're interested in hearing any of the archives of this show, is weekendinterviewshow.com. And there are, I don't know, 30-something, almost 40-something interviews up there. All heavy hitters like Thomas L. Knapp. And, you know, Tom, these first two subjects that we touched on today, the Bill of Rights, obviously, with your BostonTeaParty.us thing that you have going, and also the war, brings to me, again, the question of the new realignment in this country and the obsolescence of liberalism and conservatism. And it's really my hope that the kind of four-sided X and Y axis chart that the libertarians pass around is really becoming more and more the way people see politics instead of just in left-right terms. What do you think?
Well, I don't know, Scott. One could hope so. I don't know if I'm giving a good interview today precisely because of an issue with that. I'm speaking for myself as sort of an unaligned guy right now, and it seems to me that back in the 40s, Aldous Huxley did some experiments with psychedelic drugs. And he gave LSD to spiders, and they formed like these really geometric webs. And then he gave mescaline to the spiders, and they made these webs that just made no sense. And right now, to me, the political web in the United States is like a mescaline web. who's on what side and why is something that's just entirely difficult to figure out. The Democrats are supposedly rethinking their entire platform and their approach. The Republicans aren't rethinking their approach, but their approach doesn't resemble anything they've had to say for the last 50 years about what their approach supposedly was. And I think we probably do have a lot of people who are politically at loose ends, consider themselves homeless. The Libertarian Party has not been able to position itself to take advantage of that. Hopefully that will change. But it's a very confusing time in American politics right now to me.
I have to agree with you. In fact, you know, I find people sometimes who are completely for free markets, but they love war. Or they're, I don't know, I actually met a guy not too long ago who said, well, you know, I agree with the right wing on some things and the left wing on some things. And I said, oh, good, man. Hey, maybe you're a libertarian. And he said, yeah, I think there ought to be a welfare state and a warfare state. Oh, man.
Whoa.
You're on the wrong end of the spectrum, man. Whichever direction it goes, you're not where I want to be.
Well,
tell you what.
I don't know. The thing is, a lot of us, or maybe not a lot of us, maybe that's the problem, people seem to seek an all-encompassing paradigm for their politics. Instead of it being like a buffet where you pick this issue or pick that issue. And the war issue has really hit the libertarian movement hard, I think, in that respect, as different libertarians try to come to grips with it and come to different conclusions. So we have a fracture in our own movement where the idea of this all-encompassing political philosophy, you have one group that thinks the only way to meet the demands of that philosophy is to go to war in Iraq, and another group that thinks that the only way to meet the demands of that philosophy is to avoid doing things like that. I happen to have come down on the side that says libertarians shouldn't be supporting the war in Iraq. I've generally come down that way on a practical rather than philosophical level or approach.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, war is ugly and nasty, and if you're an anarchist as I am, it's an activity of the state, which right there makes it wrong. But at the same time, within the libertarian, you know, non-initiation of force, if we had an America where taxes were voluntary and the military was voluntarily financed, I would have a hard time making a philosophical case that it was bad to displace Saddam Hussein using that army. It's the practical case is what it makes to me. It's a bad strategy.
The problem is, though, if it was all voluntarily funded and so forth, is there are at least almost 20,000 people dead, according to Lancet, the British medical journal, as many as 100,000 civilians dead, and Saddam Hussein's still alive, and they're dropping charges, you know, pretty much every day because they don't have anything on them.
Well, that's a practical level thing.
Well, it's a moral level too thing, isn't it? That all the civilians being killed and not the guy that we went there supposedly to remove from power?
Right. Practically, can we go into Iraq and do this thing without, as a consequence, being required to violate our own principles? Innocent people have been killed, people who have never initiated force against anyone. That right there is a violation of libertarian principles. To me, it was a practical matter, not of, is it a bad idea to go replace Saddam Hussein? Do we have to be non-interventionist? But can we be interventionist without, as a consequence, violating our principles in other respects?
Right.
And also without having, just simply unintended bad consequences. We've destabilized the Middle East. We've given, once the U.S. pulls out of Iraq, which it will do sooner or later, Iran is going to have a free hand in the region, which they did not have when Saddam Hussein was lurking over there threatening them. Southern Iraq will probably become part of a greater Iran.
Which will just serve as a great excuse to war against them later.
Yeah, the whole thing with Iran is, Bush included them in the axis of evil. Apart from Israel, Iran is the only country in the region that can make a real claim to be a robust parliamentary democracy based on universal suffrage. They do have some restrictions. They have a board that says who can run for office and who can't, but we're familiar with that in the United States. We have all kinds of bureaucrats who say, oh, well, you can't be on the ballot.
Yeah, but our bureaucrats don't wear black turbans, so it's different.
Oh, of course. It's always different because it's America, which is a narcissistic attitude that I tend to oppose.
I read something not too long ago, Tom, where I wish I remembered who wrote it so I could give them credit for it, but it was something about how Americans don't believe in foreigners. How, like, really, for the most part, the American people might as well live on their own little planet, that there's no consequences, that if you go across the ocean from here, it must just be the edge of the world, because have absolutely no concept of what the rest of the world is like, whether they approve of the way we go about our foreign policy or anything else. In fact, a poll not too long ago said that most Americans believe that the world approved of our invasion of Iraq.
I can buy that. I would even go so far as to say that there are basically three groups in America, and from biggest to smallest, there's the group that really does not take any account of the rest of the world at all. They know in their head that there's other countries out there and that there are other people, but they don't consider it consequential. The second largest group is the group that knows of these other countries but thinks that inside every Saudi or every Cambodian or every Chinaman, there's an American trying to get out. And that if we just walk over and say this is how it's going to be, they're going to go, oh, okay. And then the smallest group is the group that basically realizes that even, you know, while people are people around the world and there are some of the same common attributes, that it's not necessarily true that someone in Paris or Ankara or Beijing or Osaka is going to think about things the same way Americans do.
It's true. Well, and they're just an invasion away from thinking just like us.
Of course.
So all we got to do.
That's what the second group thinks, I believe, you know, is that if we send a bunch of guys with U.S. Army on their chest over there with guns and straighten them out, that they'll straighten out, fly right, and realize that we have everything right.
My gut tells me that this is really leftover brainwashing from World War II. And, you know, the good war and the greatest generation and all that, where, you know, people still think it's the 1940s and that we'll be seen as liberators wherever we go, and all the evidence to the contrary notwithstanding.
It could be. I've reached conclusions over the last couple of years that, let's get this straight. There is such a thing as good and evil, and that seems to be the root thing that people can agree on. The thing with World War II is that there was a very high consensus among Americans that, you know, we were good and Hitler was evil, and that was correct. But if you look at the situations we've gotten into since then, there's a lot less to be said that side A has everything right and side B has everything wrong.
Well, sure, and the more we export our values, the less meaningful they are. I mean, we've come to bring you individual liberty, unless you happen to live in this neighborhood near an insurgent. In that case, we're dropping a bomb on you from the sky, and you'll strictly be collateral damage and not an individual worthy of a right to live whatsoever.
Right. I don't think Dale Carnegie would have concurred with that.
not how to win friends and influence people, huh?
Right. You know, if there is one respect in which people all over the world are the same and will react in the same way, it's that, you know, if you're shooting at them and killing them, they're not going to be inclined to say, oh, well, what do you want? Let me give it to you. Or, oh, I'm willing to listen to your point of view. They're going to defend themselves. And if you look at Iraq, that's a country of 25 million people. I'm not saying all of them were fans of Saddam Hussein. I don't think they were. But when you drop 150,000 foreign troops into their country who are going around telling them how to act, telling them how to live, pointing guns at them, killing some of them, they are probably not going to sit down and have a philosophical meditation on how much better things are now than that they were under Saddam. They're going to concentrate on getting rid of those foreign troops.
Definitely, and especially, you know, with all the hypocrisy behind the numbers of whether it's 200,000 or 300,000 that people are always throwing out that Saddam Hussein killed. Well, when he killed all those Kurds, it was with our help. And in fact, recently they dropped the charges of the Halabja massacre against Saddam Hussein. Apparently, it's looking more and more like it was actually Iran that did it, not us. But either way, we still were supporting him during that time. And then the rest of those numbers are basically the result of our little Bay of Pigs maneuver in 1991, when we told the Shia to rise up and that we would back them up in overthrowing Hussein. But then we did a Bay of Pigs and left them high and dry.
I don't know. I have no doubt whatsoever that Saddam Hussein tortured people, murdered people. The numbers I've heard, the most credible number I've heard is 290,000 civilians he's accused of killing. Lancet says we've killed a third as many in 18 months as he was accused of killing in 30 years. So it would be hard to make the case that the U.S. has been less brutal than Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
Well,
if he killed 300,000 people in 30 years and we've killed 100,000 people in less than two, the math says that we're seven times as brutal as he was. And while we may think that there are ethical or philosophical or strategic reasons for that, the people who are on the receiving end of that killing probably are not going to see things that way.
I can't imagine Americans seeing things that way if it was a foreign occupying army in our land. Or maybe we would if the Republicans told us it was a great idea. Maybe it would be just fine.
I don't know. The one thing I've come to realize over the last few years is that while I have my ideas of how things ought to be, they aren't that way. And that libertarians, myself included, apparently have not yet come to grips with how most Americans think. And until we do, we're not going to make progress.
Hey, Tom, we have a caller calling in has a question for you here. Do you mind taking a call?
Absolutely.
All right, let's talk to Doug in Florida. Welcome to the show, Doug. Still there?
No, I really did have a question. I wanted to go back to your when you were talking about the Bill of Rights earlier, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
Absolutely, sir.
One of the things that has bothered me over my courses of study for the last 6-7 years has been, you know, trying to get to the truth, of course, like most of us. And when you talk about the Bill of Rights, you cannot talk about the Bill of Rights without including the 14th Amendment, even though most people believe it wasn't, and I believe it was not ratified properly and therefore is not law. But if you go to the annotated version of the Constitution, and you can find that at the U.S. Code, U.S. Representatives, I believe they have a link to it, and you can read very long parts about how it did what they call selective incorporation. And that describes exactly how the courts are interpreting the Bill of Rights and forces it on the states because of the 14th Amendment. And I just wanted to add that to your repertoire because it's very important to, if you're going to discuss the Bill of Rights. That's all I really had.
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad you brought it up. And there's all kinds of controversy around the 14th Amendment. You know, did it create a different class of citizen? Did it extend all the Bill of Rights protections to the states against their state governments? Hugo Black, the Supreme Court justice, came up with a dissenting opinion in a case in the early 1940s, I forget what year, that basically it was the doctrine of incorporation, that all of the prohibitions in the Bill of Rights against what the federal government could do also applied to the state governments. And while, you know, I'm willing to buy that, but it's not something I'm personally pushing on this Bill of Rights enforcement campaign and this website, you know, I think that the first 10 are a great place to start, and that if we have state organizations doing the same thing, then they, you know, they can use the 14th Amendment as justification if they want to.
Well, the only problem I find with what you've said there is that if you don't push it and don't let people know about it when they do try to follow you and back up what you're trying to accomplish, and then they find out that the 14th Amendment is what they've been using as the hammer to hammer down on the states and, you know, apply it just as you said, then that becomes a wrinkle in your push, and that's why I think it should always be brought up. Personally, that's how I think it should be.
You may be right. Now, let's not misunderstand what I'm trying to do with the Boston Tea Party. What I'm trying to do with the Boston Tea Party is get people together that care about the Bill of Rights and get them to pledge money to a presidential candidate who supports it. And they're going to make their own decisions about what that candidate says about the 14th Amendment as to whether he's right with the Bill of Rights or not.
Well, and the major point here is that nobody knows anything about the Bill of Rights at all. I mean, you look at American culture as a cross-section. Who can name all the rights guaranteed in the First Amendment? Who has memorized the Fourth? Who understands the wording of the Second Amendment or the Fifth or the Sixth? Barely anybody. If we could just have a general level of consciousness about the very existence of the Bill of Rights raised, that would be doing a heck of a lot, all the, you know, technicalities aside.
You know, interesting part about the 14th Amendment and its ratification, supposed ratification, was that one of the primary reasons that they were implementing that particular amendment was to give the blacks protection so that they could carry arms, because they were being refused the right to carry arms for the protection of their life and property. And now, of course, through this ridiculous selective incorporation, they're saying it's the states rather than the federal government. It's one place. If they're going to incorporate it, that's the place where it should have been incorporated, which I never could figure out.
I agree on that entirely. Even without the 14th Amendment, the Second Amendment is clear that the right to keep and bear arms is a right reserved to the people, not to the states.
Yeah, and there's been, and you notice, as most people will notice, there's been very few places where it's been allowed to come before the Supreme Court, because I think they're afraid to have to deal with the issue, because if they do, then the true nature of it, if someone presents it properly and presents all the facts and does it in a very thorough manner, I think what you're saying is exactly what will happen, because really what they meant is some military arms. That means that you should be able to have a howitzer if you want to.
Well, and I think that's probably correct, Doug, why the last time the Supreme Court heard a Second Amendment case was in the 1930s. Miller, I think, was the last time they even heard it.
Well, and in Miller, a lot of people, you know, don't read Miller, but what Miller says
oh,
is...
Oh, gotta go, Tom.
Has...
We'll be right back with Miller. The Weekend Interview Show. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. Tom Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com. And if you would like to send me some hate mail, that would be scott@weekendinterviewshow.com. Thanks for listening. And our guest this hour, we're wrapping up our interview with Tom Knapp. You can read what he writes and publishes at rationalreview.com, Napster.blogspot, which is K-N-A-P-P-S-T-E-R, Napster.blogspot. StrikeTheRoot.com. He has archives of some articles there. And check out his latest political party type thing that they're setting up to promote the Bill of Rights, BostonT.us. Now, Tom, when you were so rudely interrupted by me in the commercial break, you were about to wrap up the last little bit about Miller versus U.S. And then in the last couple of minutes, I want to ask you about China. So be quick on the gun thing.
Okay, let's hit Miller. The thing with Miller, Miller was an itinerant moonshiner, and he was not at the Supreme Court. He was not represented by attorneys in the hearing. And the whole federal case was that since his sawed-off shotgun that he had been arrested for was not a military weapon, it could be illegalized. And that ignored the fact that sawed-off shotguns were used in World War I. They were called trench brooms. But what the U.S. Supreme Court ruling came down to is that if a weapon has military utility, the government can't regulate it. It had nothing to do with sporting arms or anything else. Basically, what the Supreme Court said was that you are free to drive down the street in a Humvee with a 50 caliber machine gun on top because that has a military, you know, utility.
But you can't carry a 9.
Right. Well, I mean, well, I don't think that 9s have military utility. I think they're a toy pistol compared to the 45, and I wish we'd never switched over. But yeah, basically the Supreme Court said you can regulate BB guns all you want. You could regulate 22 rimfire rifles that use to go squirrels. But if a weapon could be used in a military context, the Constitution says hands off.
Cool. And all that, of course, ignores the fact that the Constitution was ratified by a bunch of gun-owning people in the first place. And the Second Amendment didn't give them anything. It merely recognized their natural right to defend themselves.
Right. And the early laws required males between the ages of 18 and 40 to have military weaponry.
All right, Tom. Now, China, real quick. I barely ever get to talk about China on this show, and you wrote something really interesting for, was it the Free Market News Network?
Yes.
About China. And I want to ask you, do you think that the increase in economic liberty in communist China will lead to an increase in political liberty there?
Well, I'm not a prophet. The point of my article was that you know, liberalizing economically did not necessarily imply a chance for political liberty. The Soviet Union did so in the 1920s with the New Economic Program. So having a McDonald's in Beijing does not mean China's becoming a free country.
Didn't they, about a year ago, didn't they add some property rights protections to their constitution?
Yes, they did, but you know, can those protections be trusted? Will the next party Congress say, oh, that was a bad idea?
Yeah, any more than we can trust our government to protect us because the Bill of Rights is in our constitution, right?
Right. So with regard to China, I just really think that that you know, you can be hopeful that political liberty will take root there, but you can't say that just because there's been some economic liberalization. Deng Xiaoping was the one who launched the economic liberalization, and he said, we're not giving up socialism, we're not giving up the authority of the Communist Party, we're just trying to bring in capital.
Well, there is some good news. I actually read the other day that they're selling Man, Economy, and State by Murray Rothbard like hotcakes over there in China. So
wow.
That's a little bit of good news. Hey,
well,
thanks a lot, Tom, for coming on my show, man.
Rothbard, so.
Oh, I'm sorry, what?
If anybody can light a fire under the rear end, it's Rothbard.
You got that, man. All right. Hey, thanks a lot for coming on my show again, Tom. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on, Scott.
Hey, everybody, go to rationalreview.com. And, in fact, better yet, sign up for the Rational Review News Digest to get in your email. It's great. And we'll be right back to take your phone calls and talk about the news. I'm Scott Horton, and it's the Weekend Interview Show.